Hey folks, it's Jed Wolpaw here with just a quick message. We have switched over to a new platform, and you may start hearing some ads along with the episodes. This is really a way that we can continue to pay the growing cost of the services we need to keep the podcast coming to you without having to charge listeners. So we really want to keep the content free, and so we're going to start introducing some ads, and so if you hear them, you'll know what's going on. All right, thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the show.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm thrilled to have a somewhat different but fascinating show today. And with me, I have Dr. Trevor Gibbs. Now, Trevor is in private practice anesthesia, and we'll talk about that. He did his residency at Northwestern and then went straight back in 2007 to join a group where he still is outside of Chicago, and he's been in private practice. Now, that is not the end of the story, as you can imagine. Trevor, in addition to practicing anesthesia, also decided, and he's going to tell us this story, but he decided to become an inventor and to actually invent and then bring to market a device or something to help him in his practice. And he's going to describe it a lot better than I can, but it's really an interesting story. And one of the things I love about Trevor is that he really, when we were talking, he expressed that he really wants to help other people who may have an idea of doing something like this, but have no idea. And rather than go through all the roadblocks that he had to face without any kind of help, he wants to provide some of that help. I thought this was a great idea and something that might benefit a lot of folks out there. Now, let me say right up front that I have no investment in Trevor's company or his product. I don't own one. He hasn't sent me one for free. He hasn't sent me any money. This has nothing to do with that. This is really an attempt for us to provide some help to people out there who might have an idea and not know how to take it to the next step. So, Trevor, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jed. Thanks for having me on. I was just telling you how I've been listening to your show for a while, and especially most recently listening to the ones on cannabis. I live in Illinois. It's fully legal for recreational use now, and I'm just seeing it everywhere. And that background information has been tremendously helpful. So I'm excited to be on it, and hopefully I can pass the baton on with a little bit of information that some of your listeners may benefit from.
That would be great, Trevor. Thanks. And thanks for the kind words. So why don't we start by, you know, to say a little more about yourself than I did. Give us your background. How'd you end up in Chicago? Is that where you grew up? And then, you know, what made you choose private practice and the practice that you ended up in? How'd you pick that one?
So I grew up an Army brat. I was born in Germany. I lived there again in high school. I went to 10 schools in 12 years. We were on the go nonstop. I bounced around and went to Penn State for college and then down to Wake Forest in North Carolina for medical school. And then I wanted a little bit more of a city experience. So I said, how about Chicago? And I went to Northwestern. There I met my wife. She's from Illinois. She was working in the hospital as well. She's a dental hygienist in the dental clinic, actually. She actually did clean my teeth. And that is how we met. And I got a job, like I said, outside of Chicago in a private practice. I had an offer and had long considered staying at Northwestern. And when I heard about this practice, it seemed to be a really good fit from scope of practice. It was a physician only practice, meaning that I didn't supervise any other anesthesia providers. I liked the idea of doing my own case. I liked the idea of practicing all the things that we had learned. So I do some pediatrics, I do neurosurgery, I do, you know, offsite anesthesia, I do blocks. When I was weighing academics versus private practice, I really liked the idea of using the full scope of our training. And so that's how I settled down in my practice. Just when you're evaluating practices, I was looking for one that was rather transparent and fair from the start. And we have that. So in our group, one of the things I like, we always want to be treat people from day one, basically like they're part of the group. So they come to all the meetings, they hear about what's going on. We don't do things behind their back. You have the same call, you have the same access to vacation, all from the start. And so that seems like something that was a fit for me, and I haven't left. So I guess I must have been right.
Yeah, that sounds great, Trevor. Thanks. And, you know, I will say that that's a common thing I hear from our graduates who choose private practice, is that they want, at least at first and maybe forever, to really not narrow down their practice. They want to be able to do kind of everything. And there's no question that in academics, you don't. You know, I haven't done OB anesthesia since residency. I certainly haven't done cardiac or peds, or I haven't even done hardly any neuro. Like, we're very subspecialized.
Sure,
and
sure.
So, you know, that's obviously, it's a choice I made. I'm very happy with what I do, but I completely understand that people may want to get a wider range of things that they can do. And so that makes a ton of sense. All right. So, you know, you're there, you took this job, I'm sure you got settled in, and at some point, and tell us more, at some point you decided that in addition to practicing anesthesia, you were going to go down this path of inventing something. Was that like, were you a kid who grew up, you know, with inventor kits and always had this passion, or what led? Tell the story. What led to it?
Definitely the saying, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, happened here. You know, I went to college to become a physician. So I did, you know, biology. I didn't do any business classes. I didn't do engineering classes. The math classes I took were the calculus, you know, we had to take. And so I was just going along my way, practicing anesthesia. And one day I was on call. It was in the evening, a big patient, bowel obstruction, you know, all the things you don't want, beard and a distended abdomen and other comorbidities. And in my practice, like I said, we are physician only. So I don't supervise anybody. So in the evening, there's nobody there, no anesthesia tech, no CRNA or resident to give me a hand. And I'm rapid sequencing this patient, a little bit nervous, as we all might be in that situation. And oftentimes, many providers, and me at that time, set some of the things right on the patient's chest because it's a convenient place. I push that propofol for the rapid sequence. And as I'm going for the succinylcholine, it falls off the chest, rolls off the chest and rolls down on the ground. And I'm reaching over to get it. And it's like, oh, I'm ducking under the arm board, you know, to reach it. And by the time I get it and I pick it up, you're already hearing, you know, that change, boop, 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 you know, going down. During that time, as the nurse had reached, you know, there was a nurse in the room, she leaned across the patient, the IV pole had rolled, it rolled around over the IV tubing. So I'm trying to pull the tubing up to get the port, and I've got my sucks, the sats are going down. I'm like, this is a mess. There has got to be a better way. There should be everything right here. I'm going to order one of those anesthesia stands after the case. And when I finished the case, fortunately, I got the guy intubated. Everything went okay. And I went and I looked for an anesthesia stand. And there isn't one on the market. I looked high and low, searched all over, and I wasn't able to find one. And I began to think then about, what would I want if I would make one? And I had a few other scenarios where I thought, you know, this would have helped me there. And so that was my impetus. Right there, I said, I don't know how to do it, but I'm going to figure it out.
Well, first, Trevor, that story made me tachycardic, and now I'm waiting for my heart rate to come back down because I can imagine, well, maybe I can, I can certainly imagine it happens to all the time that the meds roll off the patient, or, you know, you put them on the edge of the bed and they not get rolled off of there, you know, and that's incredibly frustrating, but wow. The scenario is not one anybody wants to be in, and to be in that alone with no resident, no CRNA, no tech, an OR nurse who may be helpful, but is certainly not anesthesia trained. So kudos to you for recovering. So interesting that you thought of it. So what you wanted, which I think we've all been in this situation, is a convenient, easy place to put your whatever, meds, IV equipment, A-line equipment, whatever it is. And we all know, I was telling you before we started recording that the other day I was in a similar situation with an obese patient taking up the whole table, didn't have anywhere to put the meds, was looking around for a Mayo stand, couldn't find one, and thought to myself, you know what I want? I want Trevor's device. And don't have one, but I totally got that desire of how nice it would be. And so so tell us a little more specific. So it was a table that you wanted. So how, what did you actually come up with, and how? I mean, obviously you can't just say, you know, I want a table. So how'd you narrow it down? How'd you specifically design it, you know, and come up with an exact thing of what you wanted to build?
Well, obviously, I started to think about the things from that case I would have liked. And something that often happens for me is my suction tubing falls down right as I need it. You know, where you're sticking that Yankauer under your pillow, under your mat, nowhere it should be, right? And it's fallen down. So like, I want something that's gonna hold my suction tubing so it doesn't fall just when I need it. And so I began to think of some kind of clip. And so all the corners, I have these little corner grips, or like these little fingers of rubber. They're latex free, but you know, that you can wedge things in, whether it's to hold the endotracheal tube when you're intubating. So I started to envision that. I wanted something adjustable so that it could adjust and so that it could grab maybe the bed or an IV pole or a gurney. And so I started to think about that. And I wanted something, obviously, like from that story, to hold my IV tubing. I didn't want my IV tubing, you know, some people tape it to the bed, or sometimes they don't, or, you know, it's in the bed sheets. So I needed something to hold my IV tubing. And then I thought, well, if I have this thing here, maybe it should hold my circuit too. And those are the things that I started with. I needed it to do that. And then I started to think about how the surgeons, they have a back table, kind of like we have our anesthesia machine, but they don't set stuff back there. They have the Mayo stand. It's right there. And I was like, okay, so I wanted some sort of tray. And I started just to kind of literally laying in bed and different designs. And that was my first thing. I had a clamp and an adjustable neck and some sort of customized tray. And that's what I had when I was ready to set off.
So I love this, and I can already tell that you must have been that resident who, when I walk in the room, everything looks pristine. It's all organized. The IV is taped on a blue towel on the bed with the stopcock in perfect position. That, you know, everything's labeled. You know, it's like those are the residents who you walk in and you think, wow, this is a superstar resident.
That is still me. Before I leave the room, I've taken my circuit off the machine, the bag, I've thrown it away. I've hung my cords and over the IV pole so it's easy for the next person to come in and clean. Still, that's, and maybe that's why this was attractive to me. That is the way I operate. I think you'd liked supervising me in my day.
100%. I mean, that is, I tell, you know, every once in a while you have like a CA1 who does that. And I always say, wow, you are way ahead of the game. If you're already doing this as a CA1, that is awesome. Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay. So, you know, what I think is so easy to, and I just want to emphasize this because I think a lot of people have probably had the same frustrations. Can't find, and of course we all have, right? Where's my suction? Oh, you know, it fell on the ground. Or, you know, the only place left is to jam it under that probably disgustingly dirty table, right? Right. You know, under the mattress, which is, of course, it's then going in the patient's mouth.
Sure.
You know, or where's that stopcock? And, you know, is it fallen? Is it twisted? Is it under the pillow? So, you know, I think, not to mention what we already talked about, which is where am I going to put my meds and everything else. So I think we've got, but I can tell you that I have had those same frustrations and have not designed anything to fix it. And even if I were to, I think I wouldn't have the first clue. I mean, so I think what's key is that you didn't just recognize the problem and you didn't just say, okay, I need a fix. You also went through and found I want to almost say you broke it down into smaller pieces. Does that seem right? Like you didn't just say, where am I going to put stuff? You said, well, what stuff? And it's not all stuff that just needs to lay on a stand. There's some stuff that needs to be held with a clamp, like suction tubing. There's other things that, you know, we might normally tape, like a stopcock. There are things that need to be squeezed, like the suction tubing, and other things that you can't squeeze too much, like the IV tubing.
Right.
There are, and then there's where do you put this thing, right? And sometimes you have an IV pole in a convenient position. Other times that might not work. And sometimes you have a bed you can clip stuff on, and maybe other times maybe it's a special robotic bed that you can't. You know, so you kind of broke this all down. Did you consciously do that to try to break it down into component pieces?
I did think through the different challenges that we had, what was reasonable to put on that. There are some things I worked through that I thought I might be able to do, but then it was too complex to do. So yes, I did think about the different challenges and what would be reasonable on one apparatus or one device.
Okay, awesome. So you did some sketching, you did some thinking, you did pros and cons of each thing. You came up with what you thought you wanted. Then what, right? Because I think if I had to pick, as someone who's never tried this, but if I had to pick the kind of biggest point of where I bet people who have good ideas get stuck, it's, well, I have this idea, but I have no idea what to do with my idea. How would I translate this into reality? So, you know, tell us a little bit about that. How did you go from this design you had come up with on your own to the making it something real?
Well, my first thought was not, hey, let me form a company. And actually, even when I came up with this idea, I was like, I think I'll do it myself. I didn't realize that you would have to form a company with it. It may sound obvious to everyone in the world, but to me at the time, I just thought I'll make this product and it'll just go out there magically somehow. So I started to think, okay, well, let me look at some of the companies that are out there, you know, whether it's Stryker or, I don't know, some med device companies. And one of the things I found intimidating, because I didn't have any patent or even any idea about intellectual property. I had never seen Shark Tank, had never watched it till after I started this process and kind of became interested in other people's journey. So I went, as you go to a lot of the sites, whether it's some of these major distributors who have some of their own products like Sharn or whatever, they have messages about that you should protect your idea before you meet them. And here's what Stryker's page says. I have it written down because it kind of scared me off a little bit. It said, please only submit unsolicited ideas after you have first taken steps to obtain patent protection for such ideas. By submitting an idea, you agree to seek and rely exclusively upon your patent rights, if any, as defined by the claims of an issued patent, and that you will not submit suggestions for ideas that are subject to protection by design patents, copyrights, or trademarks. That was kind of scary to me. I was like, well, I don't have a patent. I guess I can't submit it, you know. And at the time, it didn't make sense. Now I understand that if they don't have this and you submit an idea to them and then they're already developing the same idea, then you might say they stole it. But at the time, it just worded me off. So I thought, well, I guess I can't do that. I don't have a patent. So I guess I'm not going to contact Medtronic or these bigger people. Well, now what? So I you know, just kind of letting you know, now there are a lot of other things you could talk to. You could talk to innovation labs, prototyping labs, accelerators, incubators, all these things. But I didn't know. And what I did find was this organization called SCORE. It's like Service Corps of Retired Executives. It's a national organization. They have mentors all over. It's a free organization. They have lectures, but they also have mentors. And so there was a chapter in my area, and I forget how I came across it, just on some Googling, but there was a mentor on there who had been an engineer and had a patent and got the device out and then eventually sold it. So I thought, well, he seems like kind of a fit. I emailed him and he said, okay, I have a lot of people come to me with ideas. Please make a little presentation and we'll talk. So that was my first step. I met with him. Then I really began to think about things. I took photos without patients in there, but of our operating table, of our anesthesia machine, of the side rail of the operating room table. I got downloaded images off of anesthesia journals and stuff I Googled to try and communicate to someone who's never been in the OR the scope of what I was trying to fix. And so I sat down and I met with him. And he listened and he said, you know, I see a lot of things come through. I think this maybe has some legs. So he knew some people, as a good mentor does. He knew a patent attorney. So we met with someone who, through the organization, gives a free hour to anybody just to kind of give you some ideas. And then he also connected me with a project manager at a prototyping lab that is part of a university nearby. And that was really my first steps.
So, you know, key things you mentioned there, mentorship, right? I mean, if you happen to know somebody who has done this, then that's great. But if you don't, then how would you find, right? It's a big question mark. And so how did you find SCORE? Would you just Google like help for inventions or?
I had come across, so they have something associated with my local library. And I think I had been in there and seen maybe a poster for it or something. And so I just, on a whim of desperation, went on their website and I saw mentorship and I clicked around. Oh, this is business. Maybe they could help me. And I just came across Bruce's name and reached out to him and got lucky that he was able to get me going in the right direction. He hadn't done medical device, but he was close enough to be able to get me my first couple steps.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And one of those was meeting with this patent attorney. And did that lead to a patent? Is that a necessary first step before you kind of go any further?
I don't know that it's a necessary first step, but a full patent. But one thing I would recommend to anybody is there's something called a provisional patent. I don't know if you've heard about those, but a provisional patent is something that you can submit. The patent office does not review it. It only costs about $100 to submit. And basically from the day you submit that, you have 1 year to submit a full patent application, and you will get the priority date of the date you submitted that provisional patent. And so what that does is you write down everything you know and drawings. It's not nearly as formal as the real one. You just have to have all the general ideas there. And once you have that, then you can submit the full one at any point. So then you can really talk to people, and you've got that as kind of some protection. So you don't necessarily need a big patent. And you might even talk with a patent attorney about helping you with the provisional, just to make sure you have all the information in there. Because my understanding is you can't put a lot of new information in the full patent. It has to most have been in that provisional. Okay. So I would say that is a nice, affordable first step if you're looking for a little bit of protection.
Okay. So did you do that?
I did that. So okay. We didn't do it that first day. There is a non-disclosure. There is a agreement with the patent attorney that he wouldn't tell other people. And so there's a little bit of a balance, right? You know, potentially someone else could be inventing the same thing, right? And if they submit it one day before you, they have priority. And it's not first to invent, it's first to file. That is the way the new rules go. And I don't know if you know much about this, but used to be you could prove that I've been working on it in 3 years and I just filed the patent now, but really I invented it then and you would get it. They don't mess with that anymore. The first person to turn in the paperwork. But on the other side, you know, you're 20 years from the day you file at the end of your patent. And also from the day I filed that provisional, I have 1 year to figure out, do I want to pay for that full patent? And so I was balancing.
And what's that cost? What's a full patent cost?
You know, it can be anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000. I think I've been closer to probably over 30 now because I have a patent in Canada. We filed in Europe as well. And that's a whole nother process. And then I just made a strategic bet that, you know, I didn't want it in all these other countries where I would have to litigate it because there's no patent police, right? There's nobody out there saying, oh, you don't have a patent for that. Somebody, me or representing me, would have to see a violation and then they have to do something about it. So what are the chances I'm going to see a violation in Southeast Asia? I'm not, you know, so I decided to let those go.
Okay. And so I would imagine when you get to that level, I mean, you're spending tens of thousands of dollars filing a formal patent. Unless you happen to be an attorney yourself, you probably need a patent attorney, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, the patent attorney that I first met with is the one that I ended up going with. He does 100% intellectual property. And he was really good. He let me write things that I could write to save myself a little money because they're obviously paid by the hour. For instance, the background. What's the need for this device? He said, and he was really good about going through it and explaining, you know, the reviewer for this, you need to explain the need for this. Why does someone need this and why would it need to be protected? And that stuff, obviously, I knew. So the more that I wrote, he was willing to work with me to let me write those different things. And we worked together. And as much as I could review off the clock, he did that to, you know, as a, you know, bootstrapping, very small company, that was a big help.
Yeah, that's great. And it might vary. I don't know from attorney to attorney, but is it an hourly rate? Is it do some people say, okay, look, you know, you pay me this much now, and then if you're, you know, you pay me a certain percentage of the profits, kind of thing. I mean, how do they work?
There are all kinds of those things out there. You could probably find a relationship with different companies. Mine was strictly an hourly basis. So he had no rights to the apparatus. He just gave me advice on how to write it and also just counsel on how things would go if there's a violation of my patent and strategy on how you want to time things because, like I said, there's cost at every step. And so it was strictly an hourly basis. He doesn't have any other things, but I have heard of other things going on. You know, some of those big companies out there you see advertised, Invent Help and things of that sort. You might want to talk to people before you talk to some of them. They you know, I've heard that some of them can be a little, I don't know if predatory is the right word, but maybe if you're a little naive in the area, they might charge, overcharge or things of that sort. So just like every step you would go through any process, do your research, talk with a couple people. You can, you know, after this, always send me an email. I'd be happy to let you know what I know or put you in contact with someone that I trust.
That's a great offer. Thanks, Trevor. I'm sure people will take you up on that. Let me ask you what the best way for people, email is the best way if people do want to do that.
You can email me at trevorgibbs@anastan.com, or if you go to the website and just click on, I guess there it's info@anastan.com. You can reach out that way. But I'm on LinkedIn, Trevor Gibbs. You could find me there. And happy to help anybody because, you know, we're kind of in a community, right, of anesthesia providers.
Absolutely. That's very generous of you. Thank you. So at some point, people are wondering, you know, when I think of lawyers, I think of them charging quite a lot per hour. We're talking like $300 to $400 an hour kind of thing, more or less. Is that the ballpark?
Right. So my guy was $325 an hour. But you know, if you easily can spend $500 an hour or more, depending on who you find, that was the rate I had, which is still not cheap, you know, when it adds up the hours, but, it's kind of middle of the road for intellectual property lawyer.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. So at some point I imagine, and you alluded to this earlier, you must have started a company, to build around this device. Tell me about that. How'd you do that? At what stage of the game did you do that?
So once we had some prototypes that I was going to have people looking at or thinking about, you wanted some sort of protection. You know, you wanted that corporate protection. If for some reason some lawsuit would come up or someone would be injured looking at it, making the product, all those things. So, you know, through SCORE, this organization, they have some different lawyers, and I found a corporate attorney to help me draw up and pick a corporate structure. And that's another thing that could be a whole other separate discussion, but whether you want to be an LLC or a C corp or an S corp, those type of things. But initially I started out as an LLC, and then based on some of the changes in tax laws, we switched over to a C corp, and that's what we are now.
Great. Okay. Yeah. I know very little about it. I ACRAC is an LLC. That's all I know is the LLC part, because same thing, you know, obviously someone could listen to this and say, I'm going to invent something because I heard Trevor talk on ACRAC about it. And then they're in the middle of inventing, they slice their finger off and then they sue. And right. All they can do at the moment is sue ACRAC, which has a net income of zero. So, so we're in good shape.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you started off as an LLC, and I think you're right. We don't need to get in, don't have time to get into all the nitty gritty of the difference between a LLC and an S corp and a C corp and all that. But the bottom line is there are multiple different ways you can structure your company. My guess is, but tell me if I'm wrong, they all provide some level of protection, like you said, so that you can't be sued for your personal house and personal, you know, money savings and car and everything by someone who, you know, is harmed in some way or thinks they're harmed by your product.
Absolutely. And, you know, if anyone ever gets to that step, you'll obviously meet with a lawyer who says it's very important to keep all of that separate from your personal finances and all that. If there's any blending between that, then they can go after you. So there's this thing, and maybe they talked about the corporate veil. You don't want to pierce the corporate veil. The money that goes into the corporate account stays in the corporate account. You have to have minutes of an annual meeting, and there's all these requirements that is out there. Anyone can Google it and find it. But it is important to keep any business, yours or mine, separate from your personal life.
Yeah. I think that sounds good and is good advice. So, all right. So you met with this lawyer, started as an LLC, at some point made a conversion based on tax laws and stuff. Was that before or after you filed your provisional or permanent patent?
That was after. That was after I filed submitted the provisional patent.
Okay.
Like I said, once I was doing things that I thought might need corporate protection, and everything I'm trying to put off as long as I had to, for a time and a cost reasons, you know, didn't do them till I really felt it was the necessary step.
Okay. So now we're at a point where you formed a company, you have applied for provisional patent, you're working on a permanent patent application, you're working with a lawyer. Are you also during this time, you know, doing more design and you know, what's happening with the product itself?
So I filed that provisional patent after I had my first prototype. So my first 3D printed prototype. So, you know, I met with that mentor. He put me in touch with a project manager who then had a engineer that he worked with. And we all had a meeting and I brought my drawings and I brought some pictures and I kind of gave them the same presentation I had given to that initial mentor. And through that, they made the first CAD drawings, very rough CAD, you know, computer assisted design drawings of what this might look like. And it was not, much less detailed than what we have, but it was somewhat similar to what you see today out there with my product. So I did that. I made that. We revised it, and then we 3D printed up our first version of it. And when I took that into the operating room, not for patient use, but just to see, okay, will this grab the operating room table bed? Will this grab the IV pole? Will this work? And once I said, before I did that, I filed the provisional patent, because if somebody saw that, then there is a way to invalidate your patent, even if it was a staff, maintenance staff or anything like that. So before I took that out, where anyone who was not under an NDA might see it, that's when we filed.
An NDA is non-disclosure agreement.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So important, and I would imagine that while this could sound paranoid, I mean, what you've really laid out here is you're going to put this much time, effort, and money into something. It's not worth taking the chance, right? Like, just make sure you cover your bases before anyone could see it, file that thing. And it might not even be someone who is out there, trying to undercut you. It might be someone who's had a similar idea, but they couldn't quite figure out how to conceptualize it. Then they see it and they think, oh, that's what I wanted to do, right? And so then they feel like, oh yeah, I mean, I was already there. I just, you just gave me a little bit of push. But if you haven't filed yours and they file theirs, then right. You're done.
Right. Yeah. Now, remember that you can sell something without, as long as someone else doesn't have the patent, you can sell things. You can make money on without a patent. And patents are a lot of money, time, and effort. And so just because you have a patent doesn't mean you're going to make money. I mean, the percentage of people make money off their patent is under 5%, it's a consideration to decide you're going to go through with that. And like I said, and as you mentioned there, I was just working on the provisional patent now. So that is a nice option to put out not that much money and get the idea where then maybe you can go talk and we can talk about the options of how you might want to take it with one of those bigger companies. But yes, I wanted the protection. And through this process, I think a lot of anesthesia providers, at least myself, are a little bit conservative in nature. We wanted to make sure everything is conservative. And I thought with this other venture, I'm going to go for it a little bit more than I usually would in my regular life. When there's a chance to be conservative or go for it, I'm going to go for it. And that's pretty much at every split in the road, that's what I've done. What's a little bit more getting out over my skis? All right, I'm going to do that one. Whether it's, okay, I'll pay for the European patent. Maybe I'll lose the money, but maybe it's going to be popular in Europe too. So, it's a little bit of an, I don't say alter ego, but an opportunity to do something not only different in the type of stuff that I'm doing, but the way I approach things as well.
Yeah.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Absolutely. All right. So here you are, you got your provisional patent filed, you come in to the operating room just to try it out. So that's you were saying. So how did that work? Your initial prototype, you had 3D printed it, you brought it in, and what'd you find?
I found, okay, it works. I could see that there would be a version of this that would do what I wanted to do. The clamp was where a lot of our It's kind of, you look at it, it's just a clamp, but there are a lot of things that we had to put together to get it to land in the right spot and to be able to grab all these different things. And it did that. It grabbed the side rail, it grabbed the IV bed. Okay. It did that. And then this tray, yep, the IV clips in there and the okay. All the things that I wanted to do, it did somewhat. So I thought, all right, we're ready for the next step. Let's fix all of these. And I mean, I went home. I remember trying that. What I did was I took it in one night when I was on call and it was quiet. And I was like, okay, I'll just clip it on here. And there's nothing going on. And boy, I don't say all night, but for a long time I was sketching. Okay, this needs to be this size. And over the next couple of years, I kept in my bag a set of calipers and measuring, like I said, the thickness of the side rail on the bed and thickness of the gurney rails on your transport beds and then the inpatient beds, how thick are the rails and all the different, you know, I was measuring things all the time. And so from then, we just went through a series of revisions, you know, of you know, making everything a little bit better and getting it to the point where it was ready for the next type of prototype. So we did 3D printing and then we got to something. I'm like, okay, this is still the 3D printing material is a little bit weak. It was a little bit heavy. We need something that's closer to the real material. So we did something called urethane casting, which basically pours urethane into like a silicone mold and gives us something that's much closer to the final material we were going to use. And when we got there, then we could really test the product.
Now, let's back up a second because so first, who's we? You and like your mentor or yeah, who's working with you?
Me and the engineers I worked with and then the prototyping lab, my project.
And where did you get, where did you find the engineers and how did you get a lab?
So the mentor, Bruce, knew of this prototyping lab that was nearby. And so I went to them and they knew the engineer. And so, the engineer and, you know, the engineering firm, I guess I should say, but it was just one guy I worked with most of the time. And then his computer drawing guy. And so those guys were people I was emailing all the time. Okay. Here's a picture of this. Here's this. And they all worked on an hourly basis as well. So I didn't have to hire them. They were contracted and still remain that way if I need something now.
Okay. So, you know, you got access to this lab, at which I assume the lab came along with these various molds and things you just explained.
Yeah, they have, you know, they have a large 3D printer. They have all kinds of, you know, hardware machinery to kind of, I don't say jerry rig, but make rather more primitive prototypes. So things that they need to cut metal or wood or, you know, just for conceptual purposes, they have all that in there.
Now, you know, even just up to this point, and we're not yet at a product that is ready to be sold. We've talked about a lot of expenditures, right? There's the hours for the patent attorney. There's the hours for the engineers. There's the, you know, whatever money you have to pay to use the lab. There's the materials. Is this all you're coming out of pocket or did you at some point apply for some funding?
I'm all self-funded and I self-funded for quite a while. And then I, serendipitously came across another company who was interested in my product. A guy I trained with was a cardiologist that knew someone was a CMO in a medical device company, and they were interested. And at the time, it was sounding a little bit attractive. You know, as you mentioned, expenses go up. There's a lot to do. I needed some help. And so I was at a crossroads. I was like, what do I want to do? And I had some people say nice things. Oh, this sounds like something I might like, but people say nice things. So I said, I got together with some of these people and I said, all right, would you be willing to not only put money and a significant amount of money, but time to help the project along? And if they were willing to do that, then maybe it would be the help I needed. It would be the money I needed. And also some validation. Okay, they actually like this idea. They're not just patting me on the back and say that guy's a little bit nuts. And when I had that meeting with several people, and they said, yeah, we want to do this, then I said, okay, we're going to stay independent. And again, taking the conservative route versus taking the getting out over my skis a little bit, I said, let's go for it. And from that point forward, you have to set up an investment structure. You have to write, you know, a kind of a brochure of all the financial risks they're going to take. And that was a whole process. And then if you're taking investors from out of state, something else, again, you know, as you go along the way, you have some people say the challenge. I say the privilege or opportunity to learn about something that you've never done before. And so I did a lot of learning about how to take investors and value the company and get ready for the next step.
Yeah. So I can't imagine how much learning there must have been along the way. So And what do the, and this may be obvious, but what do the investors get in return? Do they get stock? Do they get a piece of the company?
They got stock, yeah. They got stock, okay. And some of them were able to earn additional stock based on their role, you know, and time continuing to help with the company.
And is that is that something you negotiate with them? Like, okay, you know, you pay this much money and this much time, you're going to get X amount of stock. And is there a way to know, I mean, if you said 1,000 shares, I mean, I don't know what that means. If there's only 2,000, then I own half the company, right?
So, right. So, you know, you have to define what percentage of the company those shares represent. You talk about things like non-dilution clauses, right? So, you know, I give you 1,000 shares and then I make it the company 10 million shares, right? You know, and the next day and sell them to other people. So, you know, obviously wanted to do everything fair. I know these people. And so that was something mostly I was working with the attorney on what would be typical, you know, unusual in this process. And then I presented it to them and does this sound okay to you? And they all said, yeah, that sounds like a fair valuation, a fair investment cost, a benefit for helping. It seemed that everyone, and there was an element of trust that they trust that we've known each other for a while and that they trusted that I would not try to take advantage of them.
And I assume you keep, or maybe I shouldn't assume this, but I would think you'd keep like at least 51% for yourself so you can control.
At this point, yes. I mean, now if you would take a larger investor down the road, then that may change things. But at this point, yes, I have the majority of the control, mostly because I just have, I have a vision of where I want things to go. And if you can't do that, then it might be a little bit frustrating. So I don't want to give that up just yet.
Yeah, I would think so. So, okay. So you now have a product that's getting more and more robust. You have a company, you've got some investors. Now what, you know, you were still haven't sold anything. So how do we get from where you are now, at that point to, you know, what's the next step?
So we, you know, finished a more complex prototype, and we just did some final revisions, and now it's time to make the injection mold, right? So injection mold is, and I decided I wanted this to be made out of plastic. It's light, it's flexible, it's pliable. If a patient hits their head on it, as opposed to a Mayo stand, there's a little more give. So we picked a non-porous light plastic to use. So I thought that would be a nice material. So rather than making it out of stainless steel, I'm going to make it out of plastic. And to do that, we needed a mold. And so I had some learning to do on plastics, you know, and molds are very expensive, like very, very, they can be, mine was not $1 million, but they can be, you know, and the mold is determined by the complexity of it. So there was a lot of thinking about, are we going to make it all in one piece? Are we going to have a couple pieces that we then heat sink or kind of weld together? And so the next step was figuring out how and where we're actually going to make this device. Where are we going to make it? Where are we going to store it? How are we going to package it, label it, and on and on. So there are a lot of steps. I'm not sure which we want to tackle next, but making the device.
Yeah, making the device. So, you know, obviously, there might be, I could imagine, right? You have a large, very complex device. You probably are going to not have it just printed in one or molded into one giant thing. You're going to have pieces that you then either, as you said, heat sink or, you know, even that the end user assembles, right? Like IKEA style. But I would imagine that the less of that, the better, both in terms of durability and also just ease of use for the buyer. What did you end up with? Is this something that comes out whole or is it assembled after the mold?
So the clamp is made out of two pieces of plastic, right? So there's two pieces of plastic and then we have a pin that pivots around. We had a custom made spring. And then there's something I didn't know about called overmolding. So if you see a piece of plastic and it's got like maybe a piece, like part that's rubber for grip or something, that requires two molds. So you make the first piece and then you have another mold that where they will pour that other material around so that it kind of fuses to it. So I wanted my clamp to have some frictional surface on it for where you grab it and also where it would grab the IV pole. So we made molds, we made over molds. And it was a balance of cost to keep, like you said, I wanted this really to be durable. I didn't want this to keep breaking and people buying more. My vision wasn't to just create some disposable trail. So I wanted it simple so that it's reliable. That's when my clamp is just one simple clamp, not a bunch of moving parts. And my tray, same thing. So everything on the tray is one piece, except for the thing that holds our anesthesia circuit was made separately because that was just too complex really to do in one shot. But the way it attaches to that tray can come off. Should it break, you can replace it. But it is a very simple design. It's just basically a slot it slides into. Again, like you said, I wanted it simple and reliable. And we were able to do all that except for one part in one mold. And so that makes it a little faster to make because the guy just kind of takes it off and it's ready to go. And it was more reliable. And as a small company also, I didn't want anything that was going to have to be recalled. That might sink us as well. So yeah. I wanted to send it out and know that there's not going to be too many complaints.
I'm still amazed at how much is going into this without yet knowing it'll even sell. So you've got, you know, you're building this mold, which you said, you know, though yours wasn't, could be up to $1 million or more. You have, you know, you're then at some point obviously going to start producing them, right?
Yep.
Presumably you have to store them somewhere unless you're going to keep them in your garage. So you're paying for storage,
right.
Packaging, right? Mm-hmm. You probably have to put this thing in a box. So all these expenditures. And now at any point before you build a million of these things, do you go out and try to make sure someone's going to buy them?
Well, to some extent, yes. You know, and as I found, I feel like I'm almost 1 degree or 2 degrees of separation from almost every anesthesia provider in the country. You know, you think about guys I went to college with, who went to medical school, guys I went to med school with, residents and people you just cross paths with, or people in my practice who trained other places. So I was able to get feedback from different parts of the company, country. My sister is a nurse anesthetist out in Boston. So just able to ask around to see, would this be of benefit to you at all? But you're right. I mean, even with that, it's hard to get fully objective feedback because you can't really put it out there until you've registered with the FDA, you have product liability insurance, until you have all the things in place to protect patients and to protect yourself to really get the feedback. So it's a big leap of faith to know whether it's going to be worth it. I mean, as I told the people, you have to be willing to lose every dollar you put in this. This is not buying mutual fund. It's a high risk investment. And even there are many things that are good ideas and they don't make it for a million different reasons. And it still could be, that still could happen to me. I mean, you know, whether, you know, you're keeping your head above water and whether you take off or whether it's worth it are all still uncertainties that me, every company has, but certainly one at my stage.
Yeah. So you mentioned some important things, I think. FDA approval, because this is a medical device.
Mm-hmm.
At what stage did you embark on that?
I started it probably a year before we were going to hit the market. And you need to find somebody to help you with that. And so the first thing you do is you Google FDA approval or assistant, and you find these companies online. And they're, you know, they were like, for $55,000, we can register you and keep you compliant every year. And like $55,000, you know,
yeah.
I might not have that many sales in years, you know? So I went on a website that has a lot of freelance people for all kinds of things. And there's a surprising number of people who have medical device regulatory experience on there. People who worked for or still work for these large medical device companies. And I found several of them and interviewed them and found people at a pretty reasonable rate who helped me not only navigate the FDA, but every medical device needs a quality program. And they educate me on how we have to regularly review all our feedback, any non-compliance issues, any problems, and help me set that all up and deal with that. And should there be any audit, someone that could help me navigate that as well. And then he had to go audit where we had it made. And there's just a lot of things to do. And I read the FDA site as much as I could, just so I could communicate with them. But you're going to need some help. And to find it in an affordable way, you have to do a little bit of digging.
Okay, great. So you need someone to help you along the way. For the FDA, that makes total sense. And it's good to know that there are quite a range of potential prices you can pay. So worth, sure. As you said, spending some time getting different quotes, so to speak. Okay, so FDA. And then how about you mentioned insurance, as in, essentially, what if a patient gets hurt by your device?
Right.
Because while you may be a corporation, at some point your corporation hopefully will actually have some money, and you don't want to lose it all to a lawsuit. So how do you approach that?
So again, I did a little digging, got a few names, and you're going to need what it's called product liability insurance. And so I talked to a couple different people, and I found a terrific commercial insurance agent. She's just been great through this process with helping me get quotes, not only in the United States, but different countries. If you need higher coverage, different creative ways to do that to keep it affordable and help us protect ourselves. So yeah, product liability insurance is what you need. You'll need a commercial insurance agent. If you don't know one, or even if you do, I would ask around. Some people, the first person I talked with said, oh, it's going to take me 60 days to get a quote. The person I chose is just had it in a week. She's like, I can have your policy up and running in a week. And everything that I've done with her, she's extremely prompt. And it's so nice, you know, not just with this, but you know, running your house or anything. When you find somebody that does things in a way you expect and promptly, it's just so awesome, because there are many people I've hired along the way that just don't deliver the way they do. And it can be very frustrating.
I imagine. Okay. So I could be wrong about this, but I would imagine that for your device compared to, let's say, like a implantable cardiac defibrillator, we're talking probably about a much less expensive insurance, right? I mean, the chances that someone's going to get hurt by this table are a lot lower than something like that, right?
Absolutely. So they're going to want to know what category of FDA product it is, right? So if it's 1, 2, or 3, is it a life-sustaining device? Is there a patient contact? Is it a sterilizable device? I mean, if you have to stand by that sterilization process, that's obviously a little bit more expensive. So all those factors. And another factor is the amount of them that are out there. And that makes sense, right? There's more risk when there's more people using them. So my policy escalates the more that I sell, right? There's a sure. minimum of a certain number of sale each year. And then at the end of the year, they review that. And if I've eclipsed that, then I owe a little bit more on my policy.
Sounds reasonable. You mentioned sterilization. That's an interesting point. So it obviously needs to be cleanable. Mm-hmm. Is this something that has to be like autoclavable or just probably not, right? You can just wipe it down.
We wipe it down. So we chose polypropylene, which is a non-porous plastic, so that it can be wiped down and it shouldn't harbor bacteria and can be cleaned off like all the other surfaces that are kind of plastic, whether it's the EKG leads or anesthesia cart behind us, all those things are wiped down. This can be cleaned in the same way. Polypropylene is a sterilizable plastic, but as a company right now, because of cost reasons, right, you need validation that when it's sterilized is truly clean. Right. And so that's quite a process to get that validation. And then there's an insurance cost that goes with it. And so right now we haven't broached that. I have put it through the autoclave. I've put it through different, you know, ethylene oxide sterilizations, and it stands up to it, but we do not sell it that way. Do not recommend it. I would never say that it can be sterilized at this point. It's just, again, a strategic decision we've made to this point.
Okay. So you've got your FDA approval, I assume you got that at some point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got navigated that. You got your insurance. You've got your mold. You've made some of these things. You've gotten a lot of people expressing interest. At what point do you start selling it?
We launched, right? We launched at a wonderful time, right? Just before COVID. So it really makes it, reps can't go in anywhere. But basically our launch was just an announcement that this is available. And that was where that was near the end of 2019. So literally just before COVID. So we announce it and we start reaching out to dealers that have sales reps and things of that sort. And over the next several months, it's a process, right? They don't just bring you on. They've seen a lot of things come and go. And so they want to do their own due diligence. They want to talk to their key opinion leaders and things of that sort. So finally, I get some dealers to come on board. Then there's a lot of contract negotiations, how many, you know, samples they get per rep and what's their territory. And they have exclusive rights to that and a lot of that. And then basically we signed those contracts and then COVID hit. And so, we as soon as we had the devices ready, and like you said, all the regulatory stuff was done, we were ready to launch. But that was just starting the process of bringing in our sales roots. And that was and it's still a process, it's still growing. We're still adding different people to help us sell it. We just expanded into the Middle East, and certainly we're in Canada and things of that sort. But it's as things grow, probably slower for my company than if Stryker would bring a product to market, because they have all those steps already taken care of.
And let's just say that someone out there thinks, I want one. can they get one, or is this like you have to have a bulk order for a hospital kind of
thing? No, you can buy them. You can buy them individually off the website. I don't sell them, but one of my dealers does sell them online on his website. So it does go to a third party site. Again, that's just, you know, I had to think about that. I didn't want the, you know, on my website to worry about protecting someone's identity or credit card or things of that sort. I don't know the rules on selling medical devices across state lines. So someone can buy it in small quantities. But the best way to buy it is literally through, if you just send me an email, you know, and then I'll put you in contact with a dealer who can give you a free trial and explain it. And that's really the route that we want. We want people to be able to try it, know they like it, and then go that way.
And what does one cost? If I wanted to buy one, what would it cost me?
List price is $375, and you get the tray and the clamp, and that's reusable. Some of them, the initial ones are they're in their second year of use and doing just fine. So you're going to get, I'm sure they're going to go for years and years. It's a single fixed cost. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want some kind of recurring cost. I thought it would be an easier sell to your hospital that, hey, it's one fixed cost. So 375 and it's reusable.
Yeah, great. That strikes me as very reasonable. So now what makes most sense to me is your group or your hospital buys a certain number of these so that there's one in each OR or whatever, right? But if, let's say, somebody's hospital isn't going to do that and they just want one, is it something you imagine you could kind of like bring with you to work and use for the day and then take home? Because obviously, if you left in the OR, you're never going to see the thing again.
Right. Yeah. It's the tray, like I said, detaches. And the thought is if the tray breaks or maybe some down the road, I've had a lot of requests for other trays, like, oh, I want a cardiac anesthesia tray or a pediatric anesthesia tray or these. Have expanded out. I've sold them to perfusionists and different things. But at any rate, the tray comes off and you lay it next to the clamp stand and it doesn't take up much room. You could put it in the bottom drawer of your anesthesia cart. You could slip it into your book bag. It does not take a ton of room. So yeah, there are some providers that say, I just want one for myself, and they carry it from location to location. Mm,
love that. Okay. So obviously not the world's ideal time to start right before COVID, as you said, for a variety of reasons, but how's it looking? I mean, have you had, it sounds like you've sold some number, are you feeling good? Like this?
I'm feeling good. So actually what happened was COVID actually in some ways was a challenge, but in some ways it's been an opportunity. So we came out with an initial version, generation one, and that came out. We did have sales during COVID, not as many as you would have liked for a lot of reasons. And all the med device, companies that I work with or sales reps are hurting because they can't go in and sell all the things that they want to sell, my product being one of them. But I got enough feedback to indicate some of the early problems, or not problems, but things that could have been better. So basically we had the opportunity to come out with our minimum marketable product. And then we incorporated that and we upgraded actually the part that attaches the clamp to the tray to something that's much more versatile and much more stable. So our generation two just launched just here recently. And it feels so good because it's so much better. You know, we have people that tried the first one, said that didn't cut it. And the second one said, we see a lot of uses for this one.
And what was it about that? So the difference was the clamp?
Not the clamp, but so there's a part that attaches initially when I had it. We have a clamp and then there's an attachment to your tray. And in between, I had something called a gooseneck, which you may see from like an adjustable lamp or light that has a clamp and it moves around. And what I prioritized when I conceived this was, oh, someone would have it on clamped on the OR table, and then you'd move over, maybe you clamp it on the IV pole, and then you go down, maybe do a lab draw of the feet if the arms are tucked, and you'd clamp it down there. And so I wanted the speed of not having to adjust anything. But when you would clamp this apparatus to an IV pole and you'd bend that gooseneck, if you put too much weight on it, it would drift and some things could potentially come off. And people were frustrated with that. They would rather... I found something that with basically a thumb screw and a dual ball and socket, and it locks in. And so it's a little more effort, but that is not an issue for people. They would rather have it stable. And so we just, based on our initial feedback, made a strategic decision. It ended up being, I don't want to say the wrong one, but yeah, it was the wrong one at that point. And we learned from it, and we have got a much better product. So we came out of COVID. go ahead.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
So, yeah. So for people who bought generation one, do they get like an upgrade to generation two, or?
Most of them we've upgraded if they've reached out to us. We told our reps, go back, give them the better one. We want them to yeah. have what they expect. And so for those that were interested, we have sent the reps out with the new one to see if this is more attractive to them.
Yeah, that's great. Great of you as a company. So, and tell me how, what I may have just missed the connection, but why do you say thanks to COVID? Was this because people were trying it during COVID?
Well, you know, when you come out with, so we came out with the first version that had some things that could have been better. Not that they were dangerous, but they just ended up not being what people wanted. So if we had not had COVID, then our reps would have gotten in front of everybody. Mm. A lot of people would have been disappointed, and that would have been their first impression.
Gotcha.
And now the first impression is going to be a product that is just so much closer to what everyone envisions when they see the photographs and the videos of the product.
Gotcha. That is fortuitous. That's great. All right. So that's where we are now, right? We are, you are at in a point where you've got generation two, you were able to take feedback from users and make an upgrade. You're very happy with the product. And, now we see what happens. And it sounds like we're talking international here. So you've got the United States, Middle East, Canada, maybe some others.
Yes, absolutely. So we would love to go to Europe. We have interest from people that want to sell it there. And we have lots of people reaching out that want to buy it there. Same in Australia and New Zealand. But there are regulatory expenses and things of that sort that we haven't made the decision to make that move yet. So at some point we plan to be in Europe, but it'll be whenever it makes right from a dollars and cents standpoint.
All right. I'm going to ask a couple questions. And if any of these are like, you can't answer them because, you know, I don't know, might mess up future business, feel free to take the fifth.
Okay.
But so one is, you know, this sounds to me like something that, you know, already is starting to be successful and could easily be very successful. At some point, I have to imagine that somebody like Stryker or, you know, the equivalent is going to come and say, we want to buy you. Would you do it? I mean, obviously it depends on what they're offering, but, you know, like, is there a right. piece of you that feels like, no, like, this is my baby. I want to keep it and run it and see where it goes. Or is it, would you say, well, hey, if you offer me a big enough paycheck, sure, you can have it.
Well, you know, throughout this process, I've said I always do I'm for whatever makes sense, whatever works. And so I would certainly listen, to what they offer. I'm always doing things so that if I did need to sell, we're set up for that, right? So professional bookkeeping, redundancy in the corporation. So there's other people, God forbid something happens to me, that they know what's going on. And so you built it in a way that would be attractive. I've liked the process. And the more success you have, the more fun it is to get things moving. So I'm not shopping it around. But I imagine if someone came to me and then there was going to be more medical device opportunity down the road, then I would be open to it. I'm not dead set one way or the other. It's just part of the journey. So,
yeah. Okay, great. Now, question number two, let's say that that happens and you make enough off this that you don't have to do anything else. Okay. Mm-hmm. Two questions. One, do you keep doing, do you keep practicing anesthesia? And two, would you want, even though you wouldn't need to, would you want to come up with a new device? I mean, have you enjoyed this process enough that you think, I want to do another one? I don't know what it is yet, but I'd love to.
I'll tell you a couple questions. I would still practice. Obviously, I think it would be a different
a different
schedule. You know, I mean, would I take call? And, you know, yes, my schedule would certainly be different, but you know, our operating room is my inspiration, right? We all have challenges we come across, and the initial ways to solve them, I could test myself there or kind of with the concepts to solve that problem. So I would probably continue to practice, but it would be with a different schedule. And I think that would be ideal, actually. And coming up with another one, the nice thing about that, I would have the inspiration, but I would also have the know-how. I mean, from where I started to get to here, it would be a, a tenth of the time. I mean, it just, I know all the people who to call now. I don't have to interview 10 different, you know, I have a national sales guy. He knows everybody, you know. It's just, I'd call Greg right away rather than interviewing all these people. And then how to even come up with those names, interview and everything else, the injection molder, my manufacturer, distributors. And I've come across a lot of people that maybe didn't make sense now, but I would know how to call them if I had a little bit different challenge. So the process would be much less frustrating because, you know, a lot of the dead ends are just because I didn't call the right person or for whatever reason, either they aren't, don't produce a quality work I want, or that's just not exactly their niche. So yeah, I would do that again.
Awesome. What about, and again, since I'm so inexpert on this, this might be a ridiculous question, but what about going public? Is that something that might happen?
That's not my plan. You know, there would be a whole nother set of challenges, you know, that would really, you know, challenges to the company, much less flexibility to kind of just do what you want when you're running the company. When you have, there are different rules for public companies. And so that I would much prefer if I have to sell to another medical device company than go public.
Gotcha. Well, Trevor, is there anything that I didn't ask you because I wouldn't even know about it, but that as the expert in this process, you think, oh, you know, I want people to know, or do you think we covered it all?
So, you know, I guess my summary would be if someone has an idea, hey, you know, I see a problem. I think I have a solution. I'd say a couple bits of advice. The first step is make sure it's not already out there, right? Don't start spending money and time. Do a really good search to see if it's out there. Get on Google Patents and search there. Maybe someone invented it and it never caught any traction because for whatever reason, even though it seems like a good solution, people won't buy it. So I would definitely do your research. You know, they talk about finding a mentor, and that's true. Finding the right mentor is not easy though. You know, so talk with a lot of people. You know, maybe you don't have one mentor. Maybe take someone who's good at business and someone who's good at engineering, and you have to piece together the information, but talk to a lot of people, I would say would be another step. You're going to do a bunch of self-education. If you're thinking about even if you're just going to go to another big company, you know, know your options, know what that looks like. Maybe read a little bit about when they acquire products, reach out to people about it. And then if you're thinking about doing anything on your own, you're going to get a good idea of cost up front. You don't want to stall out in the middle of it. And I can tell you, there's a lot of people that reach out to me that have patents, that have paid for the patents, and they're stuck with their product. They can't get it anywhere. They either can't do the cost or they can't get in with the distribution partner. Know your market, right? You know, how many of these would you sell, you know, and how much money could a potential company have? So know your market, know the complexity of the device. You know, that would be one other thing. And finally, don't be in too much of a rush. You know, get things right, get the information you need. Don't sign a contract with the first person. Don't be in a rush to get it market. Gather your information and prepare yourself before you make any steps, because we're not trained for this, you know, and you're vulnerable. And not only could you lose your money, but you could get in trouble too. You know, you could do something that you could be liable for. So for all those reasons, be as cautious with this as you would be in our other main profession.
Yeah, that's a wonderful summary. Thank you. Yeah, and you bring up a good point. So just tell me, from the time that you first started sketching till today, how long is that?
That was, I had my first meeting in July 2016. So, you know, going on 5 years.
5 years. Okay, so you're not kidding. This is a process. To do it right takes some serious time. And it certainly sounds like you've done it right. Well, Trevor, thank you. This has been really interesting, and I think people will love this. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something for the folks in the audience that is unrelated to medicine and anesthesia, but that you'd recommend they check out?
A random recommendation would be, you know, my wife is always cold on the couch. She's always sitting there and complaining she's cold. So this year for Christmas, I bought her an old-fashioned electric blanket. I hadn't thought of it in a few years, and I don't know why it popped in my head, but I bought her this electric blanket. And not only did she love it right away, but my kids had never heard of such a thing. You know, I mean, it was like, as a kid, I felt like people knew of them. And I came home from work one day, and all four of my kids and my wife were on the love seat, this tiny love seat under the electric blanket. And the part that was laying on the ground, my dog was laying on. I mean, it was the most novel thing to them. And so, you know what? It is pretty nice to sit under an electric blanket. I had forgot about it. So I would recommend, for $30, you can get yourself a decent electric blanket, and I think you'll love it.
Do you have a, I told you before we started recording here that I almost got my wife one because she also loves to be warm and hates to be cold. And I didn't, partly because I just couldn't, there's a lot out there. They vary in price. I didn't know what was the quality and what wasn't. Do you have a recommendation for the, like, what's the one you bought that you like?
I believe it's made by Sunbeam. I got it off Amazon and I picked the size. It was a twin bed size. So something that would, you know, kind of fit on the couch, wouldn't be too large, but it was, you know, one of those ones with 35,000 five-star reviews. So
yeah,
it's worked out. So that would be something that I think your wife, your spouse, your kids, whatever, even your dog would like. So
I love it. That is awesome. Well, thank you for that recommendation. I am going to recommend a book that I just finished that my wife read and recommended to me. It's called The Vanishing Half. I don't know if you've heard of it. I'm going to tell you in 1 second who the author is. It is, but it's a wonderful book. It's by Britt Bennett. That's B-E-N-N-E-T-T. Called The Vanishing Half. It's incredibly well written. It's a novel. It's kind of fairly historically accurate in how it's based through following, and I don't want to give too much away, but it follows a family through different generations and kind of different parts of the country and different historical events. And it's really well written and really interesting. So highly recommend it.
When's it
looking
set?
For a good read.
What time is it set?
It starts in the or at least the beginning generation is kind of in the 40s to 50s, post kind of post-war, and then it goes up into the 80s to early 90s.
Okay, awesome.
I guess that's like the third generation of this family. So really, really interesting. All right, and we have two listener recommendations today. I've been remiss in not shouting these out. So from Kathy Kunis, we have a recommendation of a series called The Bureau. It's on the Sundance Channel. It's a French, about the French version of the CIA. She says it's kind of like Homeland, but in French. Sounds interesting. Homeland was great, so this sounds like it would be worth checking out. Thank you, Kathy. And then another listener, Dan Hook, and Dan, I hope I'm saying your name right, just starting CRNA school, says he read Make It Stick by Henry Roediger. And also, I guess there's multiple authors by Mark McDaniel and Peter Brown. He says his program required him to read it, and it was phenomenal. He says as much as he loves learning, he never knew there was science to learning, and he's so glad he read this book before starting an educational adventure. So check it out. Make It Stick is the name of the book. All right, thanks to our audience members, and feel free to shout out a recommendation to us anytime. You can send it on Twitter. You can send it on email, but send them to us. And if we are interested, we will shout it out on the air. Well, Trevor, thank you. As I said, this has been fantastic. And we'll put your contact information, your website on the show notes for people to check out. And I'm sure you'll be getting some emails and requests for help. Hopefully you won't regret making that offer. Good luck with the ongoing build and selling of the product. And I am going to see if I can get us some at my shop, because I think they'd be fantastic. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jed. This was awesome. I feel honored that I could have been here, because you got a great show, and I think people are learning a lot from it.
All right. That was really fantastic. I absolutely loved that interview, and I thought Trevor just was incredibly eloquent about his process and incredibly generous in his offer to help other people out who are interested. Imagine not having to go through everything he went through, because you can pick his brain about it. It's really great of him. So let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com. You can leave a comment and let us know what you thought, and others can learn from what you have to say. Have you also invented something? Let us know, and we'd love to hear. You can also, of course, join the conversation on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Walpaw, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to, you know, I always say iTunes, but I guess it's not called iTunes anymore. I think it's called Apple Podcasts or Apple Music. But please consider going to your friendly neighborhood podcast store, wherever you get your podcasts, and leaving a comment and a rating. It helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make a donation anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac or looking for Jay Walpaw on Venmo. We really appreciate all of you who are already patrons and have already made donations. It really means a lot. Big thanks, as always, to Dr. Brian Park, who is our tech lead, and to our social media manager, April Liu, and to our former media manager, who still helps us out with some of the show notes, Dr. Kimia Kashkouli. Our original ACRAG music is by the one and only Dr. Dennis Kuo, and you can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Trevor Gibbs, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.